I would like to start precisely on the recent news that have come up with the mobilization announced by the Kremlin. Seems that Ukraine is going into full-scale war and not a special operation as before. You, in this book, you have written extensively about Vladimir Putin and the inner workings of the Kremlin, and also from a quite a long time period. Would, for someone like you who have studied the way that it works from the inside, is this surprising or not really? Do you think the signs were there already?
I think it is surprising, and even the beginning of the so-called special military operation was surprising because, I mean, up till that moment, even when he was annexing Crimea or launching the hybrid war against Donbass in 2014, you know, he always did so in a way in which he retained some degree of plausible deniability. Of course, there was the troop buildup on the borders with Ukraine in 2014, but then he withdrew, he didn't invade. You know, he would been told by his people that he didn't have support on the ground in Ukraine and the Western response would be too strong. So he always kept this certain pragmatism about his actions, and there was a mask. Anything that he did that was against international law or a blatant abuse of human rights or assassinations, even, there was always this degree of deniability, not always plausible, of course, but he acted in a covert way. But in February 2014, of course, he just tore off the mask when he just decided to wade in and start killing thousands of innocent civilians for all the world to see. So that was surprising. And now I'm afraid we're just seeing the kind of the denouement of that, because obviously Russia has lost many thousands of troops, tens of thousands of troops. They've run out, and Putin is in a corner, and he doesn't want to, he believes he can't afford to lose. So he's doubling down and sending all these untrained, poor Russians in there from the poorest regions. Because all he can do now, I think, it's an attempt to hold on to the territory that they've already taken hold of and maintain position. I don't think any of those poorly equipped, badly trained or untrained new soldiers are going to be able to launch any offensives at all against the Ukrainians. The most they're going to be able to do is hold on to territory. And just Putin is just clinging on because he believes he can't afford to have any more embarrassing retreats, but actually he's just digging himself a bigger hole.
Do you think he is afraid of his political future might being in risk if the Ukraine war doesn't go as he planned, that he has somehow tied his political future to that?
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, I heard very clearly from one Russian billionaire sort of in the first month or so it was in the first 2 months of the war when Putin switched his focus from taking Kiev to trying to take this chunk of eastern Ukraine. He said that if Putin loses Donbass, then a huge battle will break out within the Kremlin elite to take over from him. So this is precisely what Putin fears. But unfortunately, his position is now already so weak that essentially he's dug himself further, because of course now he's risking all the stability, everything that he's built over his 22 years of presidency. His popularity is going to be completely evaporating now that these poor Russians are faced with the very grim realities of the war, and they're going to be losing their loved ones. Of course, his popularity is just going to be shattered. This was the source of his legitimacy among the Russian elite. So if he's not popular again, we'll see this infighting to take over from him.
You mentioned in the book how there were rumors back in 24 with the Orange Revolution, how Putin was so scared personally of the situation in Ukraine and the turning towards the West that he even considered resigning. Why do you think Ukraine is such an important part of the ideology that the current Kremlin stands for. What does Ukraine has that other former USSR republics don't have?
They somehow believe that Russia can't be an empire without Ukraine, that this is crucial for kind of Russia's standing on the world stage. They believe that sort of the West has somehow infiltrated Ukraine and has been trying to take it over. Vladimir Yakunin, who was one of Putin's closest allies, and until recently, he's an old KGB man from St. Petersburg. He's known him many years. He said that they were told by Zinoviev Brzezinski, the U.S. Security hawk, that they'd been told that a Russia without Ukraine cannot be a great country. So therefore, they believe that the CIA has plans, which it's just dusted off and taken off the shelves every few years or so, to take away Ukraine from Russia. And I think Putin is, you know, he comes from this background in the KGB, where he's from this kind of member of a so-called, you know, more progressive, though clearly he's not progressive now, but in the 80s he was part of this foreign intelligence community who really believed that communism had undermined the Russian Empire, in those days the Soviet Empire, that communist ideology meant that they were going to fail in their competition against the West, that they couldn't compete with the West under this ideology that was just essentially failing the empire. And in his first ever interview in 92, he blamed the Bolsheviks for the tragedy of the breakup of the Soviet Union, because he said they cut up the country into republics that didn't exist before. And this is why we're experiencing such a tragedy today. He's always believed that the Bolsheviks made a pact with Ukrainian nationalists, shortly after the revolution, to create a republic which he believes was always part of the Russian Empire, but he believes that Bolsheviks just gave it away because they wanted to kind of bolster their own power at that time, and they made this pact with the devil, as he sees it, with the Ukrainian nationalists. So they really see Ukraine as an integral part of Russia. Unfortunately, they don't believe it should exist. And, you know, we have people like Alexander Dugin, who has been kind of a very extremist thinker over the years. And we used to think that he was on the margins, but actually he was, you know, teaching at the Academy of General Staff for the Russian military since the early 90s. And he wrote a book in the late 90s in which he called for Ukraine to be dismembered and for Russia to take control of the Black Sea coast. And now we're seeing that playing out now, or at least an attempt to do that.
It's interesting because a lot of times when writing about Russia, there is an idea of how some ideas used to be seen as a kind of conspiracy theories. Oh, that is too much. They would not go after all those adversaries and getting them killed. Or no, they don't have a big plan to conquer part of Europe. Do you think now, considering the latest events, even the most extreme conspiracy theories now are reliable because they're not conspiracies anymore?
Yeah, I'm afraid so, because we've seen very clearly how ruthless Putin and his KGB allies are, and how far they're prepared to go to kind of preserve their own power. You know, everyone used to think that the rumors of FSB involvement in the apartment bombings in Moscow, which helped propel Putin to power and really kind of boosted his status when he kind of rode in on his white horse and said he would avenge the Muscovites for the apartment bombings, which killed so many hundreds of them while they were in their beds, and he launched this war, and everyone admired him for taking on the Chechen terrorists. But there was always this undercurrent that there was FSB involvement, and there had been some signs that they could have been involved in one former FSB general who said that he had recognized one of the people planting explosive materials under the apartment as a former FSB agent. He'd been sent to jail. But despite all this evidence, many among the Moscow elite believed, no, that couldn't really happen. Putin wouldn't kill his own citizens. But I mean, look what's happening now. I mean, even, you know, he's so openly bombing Ukrainian brothers. He called them a brother nation, and yet he's been killing tens of thousands of civilians in Ukraine. And now he's sending off his own people to essentially die and act as cannon fodder. There's no way many of them will survive.
In your book, there's a kind of line that goes through it all that focuses a lot on how we have this mentality that came from the KGB days that is at the same time combined with a lot of faith in capitalism in a sense, although not a perhaps completely free market capitalism. Do you think that is still the case in the last few months, that we have a kind of elite inside the Kremlin that combines a kind of, how you say it in the book, a Cold War mentality, but not in favor necessarily of the Bolshevik days, but in the sense of opposing the West in a sense, but at the same time not to the Western capitalism and taking advantage of it?
Yeah, I think before, for most of the Putin era, they really sought legitimacy because they were in many ways trying to gain recognition among Western markets. This helped them infiltrate and acquire soft power and influence in Western democracies and all these sort of Russian state banks and state entities that won listings on Western markets. And this kind of enabled them to have quite a huge amount of soft power and influence in the West. But, you know, since Putin launched his war in Ukraine, I mean, that's really been undermined. So in a way, they've almost jettisoned this use of capitalism because it was a tool of soft power. They sought to undermine and corrupt rivals in the West. And say, look at Germany, for instance. They had this very close relationship with the Germans, and the Germans had very often been an apologist for some of the worst aspects of Putin's rule because, you know, they were trying to maintain this business relationship, and they believe that through the business relationship things could get better in Russia, and that Putin and his allies would change. And indeed the entire West thought that the more Russia is integrated with the West, the more it would end up behaving like it. Unfortunately, that hasn't proven to be the case. And I think when Putin launched his war, he probably believed that the West was already so corrupt and undermined it wouldn't stand up against him, that already he had enough allies in the West who'd been able to corrupt, that there wouldn't be this united front. Thankfully for us, that didn't prove to be the case. Like, we found our backbone and stood up against these terrible atrocities that are being conducted by his regime. And now it seems he's even jettisoned any attempt to maintain relations with the West. I mean, all these decades in which sort of, you know, the Gazprom executives, for instance, were carefully building these relations of dependency for Germany and these other European countries on Russian gas have now been completely thrown out of the window. This is decades of work, because now
a lot of millionaires living in London and taking advantage of all the business that they set up over there.
Yeah, I mean, their empires, everything they did to build their reputations and establish their presence has also been thrown out of the window and destroyed. And for, like, the Gazprom executives, they just lost their biggest market in Europe because Russia has so blatantly used gas as a political weapon. And so far it's not working because though energy prices have risen, they've since fallen back down to July levels. And this whole gambit of trying to blackmail the West into submission just isn't working. And in the same time, he just lost a massive market and no one is ever going to believe him anymore.
Do you feel that it is because of a true belief in some kind of anti-Western ideology, or do you think it's more connected to just trying to survive internally and he is kind of scrambling around and trying to make sure he is not overthrown?
I think it's both. I think, of course, he believed that I think he really did believe that the West had infiltrated Ukraine in some way, and I think he really believed and was paranoid that the West could somehow, the US in particular, was using Ukraine as platform to undermine his own regime. They were worried about the NATO training that was going on, the weapons that were getting funneled in. But then none of that would have happened had he not annexed Crimea in 2014. Ukraine wouldn't have had a need to turn to the US in the way that it did. So they were paranoid, and to some degree it was justified, but not to the degree that he needed to launch an invasion, because of course there was no imminent threat of attack in any way. But it was also, in a way, launching the war. In some ways, it was also about his own political survival, because he'd already been 20 years in power. Economy is no longer growing. He has nothing left to offer the public. There's no reason for him to be in power apart from by having this sort of confrontation with the West, or at least a quasi-confrontation with the West. But I think really the whole thing is just this terrible, tragic miscalculation. And we've seen him time and again miscalculate with Ukraine, like when he thought he it would, by giving open support for President Yanukovych, for instance, in 2004, that this would help him win the elections. And now this time he thought that if he sends troops over the borders, launches a few missiles, that means Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky would just tremble, run away, hand over power to the Russians, and Russia didn't actually have to have a full-scale war. I think he'd been told by his FSB generals that Zelensky would run away, that he'd be able to take over within 3 days. None of the army was prepared for a long, prolonged war. So it's just a terrible, tragic series of miscalculations. And of course, he adjusted the campaign to focus on the East. And then I think, Russians very often, they'll try to wing it, make the best out of a bad situation. And I think then they thought, because there was a grain blockade and they were attempting the energy blackmail, they thought perhaps we can redraw the global trade map, because we're going to do all these deals with China and India. The West is going to be imploding economically because of inflation and the soaring cost of living, and the Western leaders won't survive this because their population will rebel. But that's not working either, because we saw, first of all, the Ukrainians hit back so strongly. We also saw Putin very clearly last week getting almost admonished by China's Xi and India's Modi that they don't support him now in this war. And more, he is not getting alternative supplies to bypass sanctions through China or through India or through Kazakhstan. One by one, they're all turning their back on him, and they will do even more so now that he's launched this mobilization.
There is a sense, looking at the past, that in the last 20 years in power, Putin has been able to slowly control every part of the apparatus, and searching away anyone that became a potential problem. And it was like that with Berezovsky and the media, and then with Khodorkovsky and Yukos. Has it come to a time where, because we are not talking about individuals that can be prosecuted and trialed or potentially poisoned, the old KGB tactics did not work, because we're talking about a country and a much larger scale situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably most of the security services are now rejecting Putin too, because actually now he's the most dangerous thing for the country, that he's launching these desperate attempts and jettisoning everything that the country has achieved over the last 30 years, or 20 years at least, of his presidency. Stability has gone, the economy has just been thrown under the bus. Now it's people are getting sent off to die for no real good reason, and this risks a huge popular revolt. And perhaps even when we see the minorities, ethnic minorities, getting sent off en masse, kind of shepherded into these planes to go and fight after no more than 2 weeks training, that means there's going to be renewed separatism in Dagestan, from Buryatia perhaps. So it could end up with the whole of the Russian Federation nation imploding. So I think probably the Russian security services now see Putin as a major threat, and I wouldn't be surprised if somebody is going to try to remove him.
And looking at the situation here in the West, and particularly in London, where you've been covering all the Kremlin people and the ones who left the Kremlin somewhat, you have focused on Sergei Pugachev as a sort of narrator somewhat throughout the book. Why did he stand out to you? What made you say, let's look into his story perhaps a bit deeper than into others? What does his story has that Khodorkovsky or Berezovsky didn't have?
You know, he was an insider in the first two terms of Putin's presidency, whereas Khodorkovsky, you know, he was in jail for 10 years since 2003. So he didn't really understand what had been happening in those years. And also even before then, he was never close to Putin. And Berezovsky, of course, he'd been in London since 2001. So Pugachev really was an opportunity to see actually who these people are. And, you know, he really did know them very well. And we know this from photographs that he has of dinners with Nikolai Patrushev, the head of the Security Council, with Igor Sechin, photographs of his with Putin, his sons hanging out with Putin's daughters, Putin's wife. So this was a person who really has unique insight into not just Putin's family, but the inner workings of the Kremlin, at least up to, you know, the first two terms. By 2010, he was getting kind of pushed out. But really, in all those sort of major developments up to that time, like he really did know, and he really was on the inside. And there was also other documentary materials that we could refer to check whether what he was saying was true or not. And you know, he was somebody that I really valued being able to speak to. And it was also the case that, you know, I found that in speaking to him, he was very consistent about what he said. You know, any controversial claims that he made, we would at least check with two or three other people. You know, we would make sure that these things could be corroborated. And I also found that the people, the Russians who had been exiled, who had lost their empires, you might at first glance think, oh, they have access to grind. Of course, they're going to exaggerate everything. But actually, this wasn't the case. These are the exiles, the ones who have lost their business empires, are the ones who can really see the true Russia, because I found that oligarchs or business people who still had assets there or businesses there, they had more to lose and they would never tell the whole truth. So I think, you know, it was a really good opportunity to speak to him. And I'm very grateful that he shared everything in the way that he did.
Your book got amazing reviews, but you also had a judicial trial on par with that. I don't know how much you can talk about that, but do you feel that influence of oligarchs like Roman Abramovich in influencing directly journalistic work in the UK as a threat that still lingers on, or has the situation with Ukraine war shifted a bit?
Yeah, I think it's really radically changed. It's almost as different as night and day. So in the year when he was pursuing me and HarperCollins, he was also going after many other newspapers. The minute you mentioned his name in connection with Putin, his lawyers would be sending legal letters. You know, he got many retractions from newspapers just by the mere mention of his name, of any connection between him and Vladimir Putin. You know, and they were really very, very threatening indeed. And this led to a great deal of self-censorship. And people were scared of him and his lawyers because it's so costly to fight any legal proceeding.
Did you feel that when writing the book, thinking maybe I shouldn't print that? Some sources say that Chelsea is... really Putin's and not Abramovich? Was that something that you considered twice?
We had. I felt that this was something in the public interest to report because, you know, he had been able to acquire soft power and influence in that way. We had three of his former associates who told me that he'd been asked to buy it on Putin's orders in order to acquire this soft power and influence. And, you know, I put this allegation to his spokesperson and we included the denial. So actually, I was very surprised when we faced a lawsuit over it, because to me, his connections with Putin were clear. It was true that I'd been working on the book for 7 years. So for a long time, I hadn't been writing about him on a day-to-day basis. So I'd never had to deal before with this legal pressure because I'd just been investigating for my book. So I was surprised because I didn't know that the climate had
how
actually
it works.
Changed. I didn't understand that all of a sudden he was trying to rewrite history and deny things that he couldn't really deny. But as I mentioned, this has now changed because he's now sanctioned precisely for his connections to Putin, for everything that, you know, he went after other newspapers for. Of course, now he's trying to take the European Union to court to claim that he's not connected to Putin and to get the sanctions lifted. But I think we can see clearly how shaky his ground is when, you know, almost officially now he is an intermediary for Putin, with the Ukrainians, and the head of the Ukrainian delegation in negotiations with Russia has said openly in interviews that yes, we tell Abramovich to go and tell his boss, meaning Putin. So I think the relationship is now quite clear and he can't argue.
It's also quite interesting how during the negotiations with the Ukrainians, there was talks that there might have been poisonings in those negotiations as well.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is something that keeps popping up when we're talking about connections with the Kremlin?
Well, you know, I think in that case with Abramovich, I think clearly, you know, the Kremlin is not monolithic. There are hawks in the Kremlin who wanted the war to pursue its toughest form. And there were the so-called Party of Peace who just wanted it to stop. And Abramovich is clearly in the Party of Peace because his own economic interests, of course, are damaged. And probably, I think, yeah, he doesn't want the war. I don't think that he is a hawk in any sense at all. So this was a warning to him. I think if they wanted to kill him, they would have killed him. Of course, since then, you know, we've seen this spate of other killings of executives at Russian state companies, other business people, or
falling out the windows,
Institute falling out of windows, and I'm afraid this is it's a sign of the great upheaval the regime is going through. We saw this as well, for instance, in the last days of the communist regime. For instance, there was the head of the communist property department who fell to his death from a window just after the failed August coup, when, you know, the days of the Communist Party were over, and he was followed shortly after by his predecessor in that role, and then by somebody else who looked after the Communist Party's American property. And so it seems to have been a tradition. I mean, at that time, these people seem to fall to their deaths because they may have known too much about sort of where money was buried, who siphoned what, and people didn't want them to be able to tell. I think in this case, perhaps, yes, it's a sign of the great chaos and uncertainty, but we don't know in each individual case what was going on. Perhaps these people had pocketed some money when they shouldn't have done. Perhaps they'd been informing about money transfers, bypassing sanctions. We just don't know. But it's a sign of the huge tension within the Russian elite.